thing. Besides, I don't see what the big deal is, Becca says. She looks at Claire, then back at the group. It's not like I did anything to you guys.
Debbie snorts.
Yes, says Tara. Yes, you did.
She looks down at her lap, cracks her knuckles.
What you did affected all of us. Me, Debbie, Callie, all of us.
Us. This is the first time I've been included in us. My cheeks flush. Becca's gaze travels around the circle. She looks hopeful and doubtful at the same time.
We...
Tara can't finish. We were scared, says Sydney all in a rush. We... You know, we want you to get better. That's why we're all here, isn't it? To get better. I check to see how people are responding to this question. Tara nods. Debbie nods. Tiffany shrugs. Amanda checks her watch. Becca looks stunned. Claire finally says something.
Becca? How are you doing?
Becca doesn't answer.
You look upset.
Becca nods, then says to Claire,
Is it okay if I go back to the infirmary for a while?
Claire says that's fine, that maybe this is a lot to take in on her first day back. Then she goes to the door and signals an attendant. Marie comes, releases the brake on Becca's chair, and wheels her away. When Becca's gone, we all sit there looking at Debbie. Mascara is running down her cheeks, and a muscle is working in her jaw, but she's staring off into space.
You okay? Says Sydney at last.
Debbie nods vacantly. People look around, not sure what to do.
Are you sure? Says Tara.
Yeah,
Debbie says, finally breaking off her stare.
Yeah, she says. I'm fine.
Then she turns to me.
What about you?
She says, wiping her face with the back of her hand.
Are you okay?
I can feel heads turning around the circle to look at me.
Sure, I say.
Yeah.
Debbie smiles, then claps a hand over her mouth.
I did it again, she says, taking care of everybody else. What do you call it, Amanda?
Amanda's face is a mixture of surprise and mischief.
Codependent, she says. You're being codependent again.
Debbie laughs. It's a nervous laugh, but everyone laughs too, out of relief. All of us. Now that I've been upgraded to a level 2, I can escort myself places. Tonight I'm on my way to the game room, even though I don't really feel like playing Connect 4, and even though everyone else is in the day room. I really feel like watching TV, because I haven't seen a single show since I got here, but I'm not sure I can just walk in and sit down with everybody after all this time. I walk past the door and notice Tara's baseball cap turning as I go by.
Callie?
I turn around and see her running down the hall behind me. She scuffs along in her slippers, then slides to a stop when she gets to me, like one of Sam's hockey players.
Hey!
She's panting. The thought crosses my mind that Tara could have a heart attack if she doesn't get better. I stop and wait for her to catch her breath.
Phew!
She smiles.
We were wondering if you wanted to watch TV.
She tips her head toward the day room.
You know, with the group. Unless you don't want to. It's okay if you want to be alone.
She's still breathing hard. Sure, I say, looking at her hopeful, embarrassed face. Sure. Sydney and Debbie are on the couch. Tiffany's on the floor, flipping through a magazine and watching TV at the same time. Sydney looks up when I come in, slides down the couch, and pats the seat next to her. ST, she says. Sit here. The couch is a big, bumpy, overstuffed thing, and when I sit back, my feet don't touch the floor. Tara sits down next to me, and I notice that her feet don't touch either. They're watching Jeopardy. It's time for the daily double. A contestant named Tim has chosen silent film stars for $500. The host asks the big question. This actress, dubbed America's Sweetheart, starred in the original film version of Heidi.
Come on, Tim,
Sydney chants.
Shirley Temple?
Suggests Debbie.
No,
says Tiffany. It's a silent film star. I know this one. I know the answer. I know it from watching TV with Sam on Saturday afternoons when our mom is resting.
Mary Pickford, I whisper.
Then louder. Mary Pickford. Tim hits the buzzer. Who was Mary Pickford? The Daily Double alarm goes off. Tim jumps up and down. Sydney thumps me on the back.
Way to go, ST! You win the Daily Double!
The next morning at breakfast, Tiffany announces flatly that she's going home.
The insurance ran out, she says,
pushing her scrambled eggs around on her plate.
They thought I could stay for a couple of months, but now they say they'll pay for only a month, which is over today.
You lucky dog, says Amanda. Tiffany grunts. Aren't you happy? Says Tara. Tiffany puts salt on her eggs, pushes them around some more, then sets her fork down.
No.
Why not? I thought you hated it here.
Tiffany shakes her head.
You think this place is crazy? You should try living with my family.
A couple of people nod. No one seems able to eat. What will you do? Says Sydney after a while. You know, to get better.
They're sending me to some outpatient thing, some group that meets after school every day.
Tiffany waves her hand like she's brushing away a fly.
Why can't you go to school and come to group here in the afternoon? Says Sydney. It's too far, I guess, Tiffany says glumly.
Then quietly,
it won't be the same.
The chimes ring. No one moves. Then Claire comes over and tells us our group doesn't have to go straight to our usual appointments. We're allowed to walk Tiffany to the front door. We all stand around in a circle in the reception room, waiting for Tiffany's cab and not talking about her leaving. All of us except Amanda, who didn't come out of her room when it was time to walk to the front door. Tiffany's belongings hardly fill a plastic bag, and she looks small somehow, fingering the latch of her purse and pretending like she could care less about leaving. Finally, a cab pulls up and blows the horn. Sydney gives Tiffany a hug. Tara says she'll write. Debbie tells Tiffany she'll actually miss her.
You never let me get away with, you know, crap.
It's a big deal for Debbie to say crap, and I think maybe she's going to laugh, but her eyes are brimming with wetness. Tiffany punches me in the arm lightly and tells me I have to keep talking in group. I nod. Then I realize that nodding isn't talking. Okay, I say. I want to say, I promise, but my throat closes up on me. Just when everyone, including Tiffany, looks like they're going to start crying, Sydney says, Hey, now that you're leaving, why don't you tell us why you always carry that darn purse? Tiffany fiddles with the latch.
You promise you won't tell?
We promise. She opens the purse and pulls out a ratty piece of pink fabric.
My old baby blanket.
She grins and shrugs and then turns to go. When the automatic doors slide apart, a warm, moist riffle of air floats in, lifting the hair around my face. The snow has melted. Tiny green buds are forming on the tips of the trees. It dawns on me that soon it will be spring, then summer. Kids will be riding their bikes on the sidewalk. Dads will be rolling out barbecue grills. Moms will be making pitchers of lemonade. The doors slide shut, and it's winter again inside sick minds. An ache fills my chest. I want something, but I can't put a name to it. Debbie, Sydney, Tara, and I shuffle back to the dorm, not saying anything. When we get to the attendance desk, we drift apart. No one's in a hurry to go to their appointments, especially me, since I have study hall. I see Ruby putting on her coat, going off duty. What day is it in the real world, Ruby? I ask, when the other girls are gone.
The real world? What do you mean, child?
Out there. I point to the window. What day is it?
Wednesday.
No, I mean the date. What's the date? She looks over at the chalkboard. Tiffany's name has already been erased. Sydney and Tara have been upgraded to level 3s along with Debbie.
Next to Becca's name, it simply says H-Wing. Our group is down to 5. Sydney, Tara, and Debbie, who are going to graduate soon, and Amanda and me.
March 27th, Ruby says.
She says it's time for her to go home and get some sleep. She says they're doing construction in her neighborhood, and she sure hopes they're finished with the jackhammer. She appraises me, then smiles. She says not to worry and slips me a butterscotch candy. But the wanting feeling still doesn't go away. Later, after study hall, I escort myself to your office. The lights in the waiting area are off, and the UFOs outside all the shrinks' offices are quiet. I sit down in my usual chair outside your door and wait. I check my watch. If this were a dentist's office, there'd be old National Geographics to look at. Here, there are only tissue boxes and more tissue boxes. I check my watch again. You're late. 15 minutes late. I count the tissue boxes and the UFOs. I do the math. There are 1.5 tissue boxes per UFO. I check my watch again and know that you are not coming, that something's wrong. I must have made a mistake. The chalkboard probably says my appointment was changed. That happens sometimes. I decide to wait until you're 20 minutes late. Then I'll check the chalkboard. Then it dawns on me. Wednesday is your day off. I remember you saying, "See you Thursday," last time. You didn't say, "See you tomorrow." You said, "See you Thursday." I feel annoyed for some reason. Then scared. Thursday is a long time away. What will I do till then? I decide to go to study hall and figure out how many hours till tomorrow. How many hours, then how many minutes, then how many seconds. That will at least help pass the time. Study hall's closed too. My only other choice is the day room. When I walk in, the TV's on, but no one's watching it. Then I see Amanda lying down on the couch. She notices me before I can sneak out.
So, she says, you were on to Becca's scam?
I don't know how to answer. Her voice is cajoling, full of encouragement. I think I'm supposed to say yes, but somehow I don't. I shrug.
Cool, she says, sitting up. Very cool.
I sit down on a chair far from her and act very interested in the show on TV, a rerun of Family Ties. Alex is trying to keep his mom from opening the closet.
So, ST, Amanda says. What do you use?
I don't understand. She pulls up her sleeve and points to a line of purplish bumps on the inside of her arm. She twists her hand so I can see that the bumps go all the way around her wrist, like a bracelet.
You know, scissors, glass, wire.
I try to concentrate on the TV. The Family Ties mom turns her back, and the person hiding in the closet opens the door. Alex slams it shut, looking innocent. I can't exactly follow it with Amanda bugging me.
I knew a girl who used her father's credit card. Nice touch. Little hidden psychological message in that, don't you think?
I don't say anything.
My personal favorite?
Amanda maneuvers herself so she's blocking my view of the TV.
A safety pin and hairspray. Rubbing alcohol's good, too. But hairspray is the best. It makes your scars puff up.
She lies down again.
By the way, she says, I found this staple underneath one of the chairs in the study lounge. It works really well.
I remember the look on her face in study hall the day I saw her rubbing her arm on the seat of the chair while she pretended to be asleep.
Third row, last chair, she says. Just thought you might want to know, in case they find your metal thing.
On Thursday, I don't wait for you to ask me where I want to start. While you're still closing your door, I ask if you want to see my scars. Your face is neutral. Do you want to show me? You say. I nod. I pinch my sleeve between my thumb and index finger, but instead of pulling it up, I pull it down, until it covers my wrist, until it covers my hand, until my whole arm is hidden inside my sleeve. I use my mom's X-Acto knife. I stare at my shirt sleeve. or her embroidery scissors. Once I used the paper towel dispenser in the guest bathroom here. I feel the corners of my mouth turn up. I'm not happy, but somehow I have to fight the urge to smile. I check for your reaction. You're expecting something, I can tell. Your normal, calm face shows a hint of waiting. Waiting and something else. Something like hope. I roll my sleeve between my thumb and index finger. Then deliberately, with a kind of reverence, I pull my sleeve back, all the way up to the elbow, and extend my arm to you. You're not disgusted or frightened or any of the 100 wrong things you could be. You look like yourself, serious, curious, and maybe, just a little bit proud of me. I look at my arm. It's crisscrossed with pink lines, lines that strike me as delicate and faint, lines I remember making. I gently pull my sleeve back down and decide it would be good to make some kind of joke right about now. "Guess I'll never wear a strapless ball gown," I say. You look perplexed. "Debbie, you know Debbie from my group? She's always drawing fancy ball gowns. I'll have to ask her to design one for me, one that has long sleeves." I laugh. You don't. "What makes you think you'll never wear a strapless ball gown?" I shrug. I never planned on wearing fancy clothes, but for some dumb reason, now I really want to. In fact, I want to so badly, I feel like crying. "I don't know." "You might wear a ball gown someday." You say this quite surely. "I might?" You nod. "I have every reason to believe you'll do all the things every other girl does, all the things you want to do." I'm still stuck on the stupid ball gown that I never cared about until now. "With these arms?" I thrust my arms out, keeping my sleeves wrapped around my thumbs. "Those scars will fade. It looks like some have already faded." I consider this. "There are treatments, too, medical treatments that can help get rid of scars." I must look dubious because you go on. "I knew a little girl who was in a terrible car accident. A beautiful little girl whose face was absolutely covered with cuts. She had nearly 100 stitches in her face." I wince. I feel so sad. So sorry for this little girl. I want you to stop. But I need to hear more. "She's a model now," you say. "She's a very successful, very beautiful model. She had plastic surgery to get rid of her scars. You would never know what happened to her when she was younger." I like and don't like this story, but I don't know why. A bird outside your window trills. Another bird, far off, answers. "I may not want to get rid of my scars," I say finally. You nod. "They tell a story," I say. "Yes," you say. "They do." It must be the end of our time because you're standing up. I wait for you to say, "Good work, see you tomorrow." But you just stand there with your hand on the doorknob. I get to my feet and look at the clock. Our time was up a few minutes ago. I tug at the hem of my shirt. "Callie," you say, "is there something else you want to say?" I shake my head, but I don't move. "You seem to be waiting. Can you tell me what you're waiting for?" I shake my head again. Then I nod. You let go of the doorknob. I reach into my pocket and pull out the metal strip. "It's from the cafeteria," I say. You don't seem to understand. I hold it out toward you. "You're giving this to me?" I keep my eyes on the stain on the carpet and nod. "Can you tell me why?" "Not really." I roll my feet onto the sides of my sneakers. "So I don't, you know, I know I have to say more. So I don't use it." I look up from the carpet to check your reaction. You're tapping your lip with your finger. "I'm glad," you finally say. "I'm very happy that you don't want to use this to hurt yourself." My arm is getting tired. The metal strip feels very, very heavy.
Finally, when you reach out and take it, it slips from my fingers, weightless. You place it on the corner of your desk. I'll keep it here until you're ready to decide what you want to do with it. I don't understand. I get it back? I look over at the small, dull square of metal sitting on the edge of your desk, so close I could just reach out and slip it back in my pocket. Callie, your voice is a little sad. There are all kinds of things in the world you could use to hurt yourself. All kinds of things you could turn into weapons. Even if you wanted to give them all to me, it wouldn't be possible. You know that, don't you? I do know that, I guess. I nod. I can't keep you safe, you say. Only you can. That night we see Becca in the dining room with her new group from Humdinger. Maybe I've been here too long. They don't look that bad to me. Becca walks past our table carrying a glass of water. Behind her, another girl, who looks normal except for the twitchy smile on her face, is carrying two trays. They get to their table and the girl sets one of the trays down in front of Becca, pulls out a chair for her, then hands her a napkin. Debbie is staring. Then she shades her eyes, still watching Becca and her new friend. Finally, she turns to Amanda.
Guess Becca's found somebody new to be codependent.
We go back to our dinners, trying not to look at Becca anymore. The pasta tonight is especially bland. I consider going to the salad bar. I check first to see if the ghost is there waltzing. She's not. Where's the ghost? I ask Sydney. Home, she says. She went home. Tara and Sydney complain about the food, but I don't really pay attention. I'm thinking about how people leave here. Ruth, Tiffany, the ghost. Some leave on schedule, some leave without warning, but everyone leaves eventually. Tara's asking me a question. I can tell because everyone is looking at me. Huh? Is it okay with you if we let Debbie have the remote tonight? Sure, I say. Absolutely. It's a simple question, the kind of thing the group used to vote on all the time, but this time, I'm included. Debbie flips through the channel so fast it's hard to tell which show she's rejecting. She stops briefly at the food channel, where a woman in an apron is making apple brown Betty in what looks like a real kitchen.
No, Debbie says, pushing the button on the remote. Watching someone make dessert is not a good idea.
She flips through a few more stations, then stops at a show where all you can see is the front door of a house. A scratchy voice comes on.
What is the nature of your emergency?
A subtitle repeating these words scrolls by at the bottom of the screen. A child's voice, barely audible, comes next.
My mommy's on the floor.
The child starts crying. The subtitle says, Child crying.
Rescue 911, Sydney shouts. I love this show.
Debbie is transfixed, watching the screen.
Me too.
She doesn't even look over at Sydney.
Oh, wow, says Tara. I used to watch this all the time.
Me too, I say, aware that I sound surprised. Sydney glances at me.
ST, she says, in the weary old voice Sam used when he was trying to get me to understand lateral thinking. Everyone loves this show.
I don't think I have anything to talk about today, I say to you. You nod. I mean, things are going really well, I say. You smile. I talk in group, at dinner, I'm getting along with the other girls.
Good,
you say. We all watched TV together last night. You seem to be waiting for more. Oh, I say, we watched that show I told you about, Rescue 911. Your expression doesn't change. I wonder if you've ever watched Rescue 911. I wonder, again, what your life is like outside sick minds, if you watch TV like other people. Everyone loves that show, I tell you. You don't agree or disagree. I wonder if you think it's stupid to talk about a TV show in therapy. It's really good, but it's also like a home video. You know, the camera is shaky sometimes, like when they show the paramedics carrying the person to the ambulance. You don't seem especially interested.
I want you to understand about this show.
They make the ambulance sound really loud on the show. Sam says you can't hear the siren in real life.
Sam rode in an ambulance?
Yeah. Now you seem to be paying attention. I decide to tell you more. Actually, I gave him CPR before they got there.
Before the paramedics got there?
Before my parents got there. I stop a second, confused. We've entered new territory here, talking about Sam and the ambulance and the paramedics and my parents. I can't quite remember what I've told you before. I need to change the subject quickly.
You may have saved his life, you say plainly.
Huh? The idea crosses my mind idly that saying, huh, is bad manners. I should have said, pardon me.
You may have saved Sam's life.
You say this so simply, it almost seems sensible.
No, I didn't.
You lean forward.
Why do you say that?
I don't know. That only happens to kids on TV.
Like the kids on Rescue 911?
Yeah, I guess.
You gave your little brother CPR. You got help. Why isn't that like the kids on Rescue 911?
I don't know. It just isn't.
Well, you say.
I see a distinct glimmer of impatience in your eyes.
I disagree.
I'm having trouble taking all this in. This new, sort of annoyed look in your eyes and this odd new idea. It makes sense, then it doesn't. It seems right, here in a shrink's office in a loony bin called Sea Pines where there's no sea and no pines, but it can't be right in the real world.
Callie,
I try to focus on you. You seem very far away.
What are you thinking about right now? Will you tell me?
I'm thinking about the other day when you told me how people get asthma, how you said they can get it from having an infection. Sam had an infection, I hear myself say.
You wait.
He wasn't feeling good that day, the day he got so sick. I can picture him, wiping his nose and rubbing his eyes. A cold or something. When my mom called about it, the doctor said to keep an eye on him.
The day Sam had his first asthma attack, he was already sick?
I nod.
And the doctor said to keep an eye on him?
I wonder why you care about this so much. I nod once, slowly this time.
But your parents went out.
My mom had to go see Graham at the nursing home.
And your father?
I shrug.
He was out?
Yes. Then quickly, no. Well, I guess. He had to. It's okay.
Where did he go?
I bite my lip. Out.
Callie, we're out of time for today, but I want you to think about something.
I glance at you, then away.
Please, you say. Please try to see that day from a slightly different perspective. Try to imagine it as if you were on the outside, looking in. Try to think of yourself in that situation as someone else. Just a girl. A 13-year-old girl on her own. Alone. With a sick little boy.
I don't see what good this will do, and I don't plan to do it. I plan to forget about everything and go watch TV with the other girls. But I agree.
Good, you say. Good work, Callie. Excellent.
No one's in the day room. The TV's broken. I wander around and end up in study hall. No one's in there either except Cynthia, the attendant with the large multiple-choice workbook. She smiles, goes back to her work. I take my old seat by the window and watch the dog behind the maintenance shed. He barks, trots to the end of his chain, barks, trots back down the dirt path to his doghouse. I wonder if he's the dog I always hear barking during group. It's cold in here, studying. I wrap my arms around myself and wish Debbie were here with her sweater. I wish Debbie were here, and Sydney, and Tara, even Amanda. I pull my shirt close to me and think about going back to my room for a sweatshirt. I can do that now that I'm a level 2. I could just get up and leave. I think about it. Think about walking past the chair where Debbie draws her ball gowns, past the chair where Tara was sleeping when I slipped her the note from Sydney,
past Amanda's chair. Amanda's chair. The one with the staple underneath. I breathe out with a little shuddery sound. Cynthia looks up.
You cold?
I nod.
Look at you, you're shivering, she says. Why don't you go get yourself a sweater?
I don't move.
You're a two now, right? It's okay for you to be on your own.
I rise to my feet, but I don't go anywhere. I'm thinking about you, about what you said about me being a girl on my own, alone, with a sick boy.
Go on, she says.
I wonder suddenly if you'll tell my mom what I said about my dad being out when Sam was sick. My mom will get upset, then Sam will get upset. They'll get sick. Sam could even die. He could be having an attack right now and I'm not there. What if Sam is having an attack right now and I'm not there?
Go on, Cynthia says again, insistent. You're always in here. It'll do you good to get out of this place.
I know what to do then. I know exactly what to do. 3. I get up and go down the hall, past the attendance desk, past Rochelle on her orange plastic chair. She puts her finger on the page of her magazine to mark the spot, looks up, goes back to her reading. I pass the day room, which is still empty, and our group room, which is also empty. I go by Amanda's room, the phone booth, my room, down the stairs to the laundry room, past the fire exit with the "You Are Here" sign. I stand in front of a door marked Exit. I push the handle and wait for it to hold fast, to refuse to budge. But it opens, easily and noiselessly. There's a tiny metallic clink as the latch gives way, then a clank as the door falls shut behind me. Then silence. The only sound after that is the soft crunching of grass as my feet travel across the lawn. I start running. The motion of running, the cycle of one foot appearing as the other disappears, the forward swing of one arm, then the other, comes back to me effortlessly. I feel good. I put more distance between me and the "You Are Here" door. Then I feel 100 eyes on my back, so I stop and turn around. The large picture window in the group room is dark. Next to it, there's a narrow box of cold purple light, the bathroom window, where the light is always on. After the bathroom comes a row of black squares, dorm windows, where no one's home, then a square of yellow light, which I think is my room, where Sydney has probably just come back from art therapy and is sprawled out on her bed, listening to her headphones before the chimes sound for dinner. I turn and start running again. This time it's hard to get going. I put on a burst of speed, lose my balance and stumble a little, then get back in my rhythm. The last open space between sick minds and the outside world is the maintenance shed. After that, woods. The dog who lives next to the maintenance building is standing outside his house, poised, watching me. I wait for him to bark, to let everyone know I'm out here, but he doesn't. I can see his foggy puffs of breath in the cold twilight, but he doesn't move. He doesn't make a sound. Getting through the woods beyond sick minds is easy, much easier than I would have thought. The trees are evenly spaced, with plenty of room between them, as if someone planted them in rows. I look up past their trunks. Above is a canopy of boughs. They are pine trees, after all. I want to laugh. I want to turn around and go tell Sydney that Sea Pines actually does have some pines. But I don't. I keep running. There's no fence. No wall at the edge of the property. I make a note of this, too, thinking how funny it would be to tell the other girls about how there's nothing really keeping us inside this loony bin. But I keep running, until the next thing I know, I'm on the side of a road. I pass an old brick house, then a cluster of new houses. I run through an intersection, then onto the shoulder that runs alongside a highway with stores and more stores on either side. I don't know how long I've been running. I try to notice, then memorize, the things I pass, but as soon as I tell myself to remember that there was a Dairy Queen on the left, it's gone and I can't remember if it was on the right or the left and if it was a Dairy Queen or a Burger King. As I put more distance behind me and I feel the whiteout effect coming on, I try to hold one thing in my mind, my home address. I say it over and over and over, like the words to a magic spell. I repeat the house number, the road name, the town, the state, the zip code. The house number, the road name, the town, the state, the zip code. After a while, my mouth gets dry and my legs ache. It starts to get dark. Drivers put on their headlights. My feet get heavy and clumsy. I weave a little, up on the paved white line at the side of the road, then back down on the shoulder. A horn blares from behind me. I trip, suddenly awake, gravel spraying under my feet before I catch my balance. Up ahead, on a pole, is a payphone. I decide that the payphone is my goal. Suddenly, I doubt I even have the energy to make it the 30 or so steps to go that far. My feet scrape along the road. My knees go up and then down, but the payphone doesn't seem to get any closer. I stop and wonder how there can be so little difference between running and stopping. I pick up one foot and then the other and force myself to walk the last few steps. The receiver is icy cold in my hand. I stare at it a minute and remember then that I have no money. I hang up, then pick it up again. I know you're not supposed to dial 911 unless it's an emergency, but I can't remember what the other choices are. I study the face of the phone, its neat grid of square buttons. Tucked in at the bottom is one that says, "Oh." I push it and wonder if I'll get a real person or a recording. A real person, a woman who sounds like she's in a room with lots of other operators, says, "Operator, how may I assist you?" She seems to be in a big hurry. A truck rattles by, practically blowing me off my feet. "Operator," she repeats. She's already fed up with me, I can tell. I hang up. I circle the telephone pole, wondering what I was supposed to say to her. Another truck goes by. The wind cuts through my shirt. I wrap my arms around myself and wait to feel warmer. I feel colder. I pick up the receiver, push the O, and pray for a different operator to pick up. "Operator, may I help you?" This one has a tired, nice-sounding voice. "Yes, yes you can," I say. "Please." There's nothing on the other end. I wonder if she's still there. "I need to call my dad." I didn't know I was going to say this. It just comes out. There's no sound for a minute. Then she says, "You want to make that a collect call?" "Yes, yes, please," I say. I give her my dad's work number and listen to a quick succession of beeps, like the beginning of a tune I used to know. My dad answers with the name of the computer company he works for. I picture him smoothing out his tie and smiling his business smile. "Daddy?" I say. The nice, tired operator interrupts, politely telling my dad that he has a collect call from Callie. "Will you accept?"
"Yes, yes, of course," he says.
I hear two voices at once. My dad saying,
"Callie?"
and the operator thanking him for using her phone company. Then cars whiz by and I can't hear anything.
"Callie, you all right?"
I shiver. "Fine." I meant to say I'm fine, but only fine made it out.
"Where are you?"
I look around. There's a carpet sign with big paper S-A-L-E letters in the window. "I don't know for sure. The carpet store could be anywhere. I could be right around the corner from our house or a million miles away."
"I ran away."
"From Sea Pines?" I picture him covering his eyes with his hand, the way he does when he's watching his favorite football team lose on Saturday afternoon TV. I nod.
"Uh-huh. Can you tell me what's nearby?"
Across the highway is an official blue state crest that says Route 22. Underneath is a small square sign that says East. Beyond it is a Dunkin' Donuts.
"Route 22, I say. "East, I guess. Across from a Dunkin' Donuts."
He makes a sound, the same noise he makes when he's paying the bills.
"Sayville," he says. "You must be at the Dunkin' Donuts in Sayville.
I feel a little better knowing he knows where I am, even if I don't.
That's about 15 minutes from here, he says. Can you wait for me there? Can you find a place to wait? Go inside the Dunkin' Donuts, okay?
I can hear the squeak of his chair, and I picture him standing up, pushing his chair away from the desk and grabbing his keys.
I'll be there as soon as I can.
Cars whoosh by, so I'm not sure if he said goodbye. I stand on the lip of the highway waiting for a break in the traffic so I can cross over to the Dunkin' Donuts. Cars stream down the highway in an endless flow in either direction. When it's clear on one side, it's busy on the other. Finally, I cross halfway and stand on a strip of concrete in the middle of the road as the cars whiz past, practically sucking me up into their wake. After a while, I make a dash for it. The Dunkin' Donuts is warm and bright. Two men in coveralls are the only customers. They seem to be together at the counter, but they're not talking to each other, just reading different parts of the same paper side by side. I take a seat down at the other end and study the plastic labels under the rows of donuts. There are chocolate dipped, chocolate frosted, cream filled, custard filled, jelly filled. Too many choices. I sit there and concentrate on not shivering. The swinging door to the kitchen opens and a waitress in a pink apron and hat comes out. She refills the men's coffee without even asking if they want more, then comes and stands in front of me. Her plastic name tag says she's Peggy. What'll it be? She says. What will what be? I wonder. She looks me over. You want order? She says. Oh, I say. No. I mean yes. I remember then about not having any money. A glass of water. Please. She eyes me up and down. That's it? Yes. Thanks, I say. She turns around. Sorry, I say to her back. She's back in a minute with the water. Thanks, I say. But she's gone again, putting a gigantic coffee filter inside a gigantic coffee machine, then waiting on a businessman who wants a large black coffee to go. I sip my water slowly, trying to make it last. I make a conscious effort to stop shivering. It doesn't work. Peggy keeps looking over at me. I do my best to act like I don't notice. She wipes down the counter with a rag. I wrap my arms around myself. Out of the corner of my eye, I see her nod, like she's just decided something important. She flips a switch on a big machine on the counter. It drones to life. Then Peggy's standing in front of me with a cup of hot chocolate with a fancy, twirly peak of whipped cream on top. This is what you want, I think, she says. She puts another cup on the counter in front of me, splashes some coffee in it, takes a sip, swallows. She takes another sip. Runaway? I wonder then if she's going to call the police, or if anyone else from Sick Minds has ever ended up in here, and if they got kicked out or sent to Humdinger. Sort of, I say. She exhales the way Sydney does when she's blowing smoke rings. How could you tell? I say. She tips her chin up. No coat. It's a little cold out there to be going around without a coat. She smiles. I figured maybe you left somewhere in a hurry. I cut my hands around the hot chocolate, hoping the warmth from the cup will pass through to my hands. Where are you headed? Peggy says. Nowhere. Home, I guess. I shrug and stare at the tray of cream fillets. You want one of those? She says. That's okay, I say. Then, I don't have any money. She whisks a sheet of waxed paper out of a little box, grabs a cream filled, and puts it on a plate in front of me. On the house, she says. The front door opens and a family comes in. Peggy helps them pick out a dozen to go. The men down the counter pay their bill, and more people come and go while I eat my donut and drink my hot chocolate. Peggy comes back, takes a sip of her coffee, and scrunches up her nose. Cold, she says, sticking out her tongue. She studies me. Anyone know where you are? My dad. He's on his way. She nods, evidently satisfied. I feel a little proud and a little embarrassed at the same time. Listen, Peggy says.
I got a kid. He's grown now, but he's still my baby, you understand? She says this with such certainty, I can only say yes, even though I'm not sure I do understand. He still lets me fuss over him, like when he was little, she beams. When your dad gets here, he's probably gonna want to fuss over you. She sips her coffee. Let him. I'm still not warmed up, not even after my second cup of hot chocolate, when I see the reflection of a familiar white car in the window. The car rocks to a halt, and my dad jumps out, taking 3 long running strides to the door. He's not wearing a coat, and the wind is blowing his hair up in wisps around his head. Then he's inside the Dunkin' Donuts, and I'm inside a warm, dark hug, a hug that smells like aftershave and spray starch and home. His whole body is shaking, but finally, I'm not shaking anymore. When he eventually draws away from me, he looks shy. He glances down and pats his pockets like he's looking for something, and I notice that his hair has thinned a little more on top. When he looks up again, his eyes are moist. My heart hurts. He spins the vinyl stool next to me. Mind if I join you? Yes. I mean, no, I don't mind. He sits down cautiously, as if he's worried the stool is too small for him or something. He looks so tired and disheveled, his hair all mussed up like he's just woken up. I feel shy now, embarrassed for bothering him. You okay? He says finally. I guess. I shrug. The moment seems to call for a better answer, or at least a longer one. Yeah. Actually, I think I'm getting better. That's what's weird. Peggy arrives with her coffee pot. My dad says yes, please, and she pours some coffee into a mug in front of him. She gives him an appraising look, and I bob my head, wanting to tell her this is him, this is my dad. She half smiles, then pivots and goes off to wait on someone else. My dad and I sip from our mugs and stare straight ahead at the rack of donuts. The wall across from us is covered with a mirror with pink writing, advertising different donut and coffee combinations, and between the letters I can see the two of us as we sip from our mugs, then set them on the counter at the same time. I watch my dad bite his lip, then I see myself in the mirror doing the same thing. I called that place, the place where you were, and told them you were safe, he says. I nod a sort of thank you. So, he says. You went out for a jog? His face goes from joking to serious. I nod. Felt trapped? I want to agree because I think that's the answer he wants, but I can't say yes since that's not why I left. I shrug. There's a long silence, then we both start talking at the same time. You go ahead, he says. How's Sam? I say. Sam?
He's good.
Really good. He sounds like he's trying to convince me, or maybe convince himself.
He hit 60 last week.
Pounds. That's great, I say, thinking about how happy we all were when Tara weighed in at 99 last week.
Yeah, he says. Great, huh?
He still looks so tired and worried, though. I want to tell him something to cheer him up. I want to tell him everything I've learned at Sick Minds, so he knows I'm okay, so he doesn't have to worry about me. You know, I say, in a very sane, you won't believe this tone of voice. I thought it was my fault. About Sam. He glances over quickly, then away. I thought it was my fault. Sam getting sick. He looks at me again. This time like he's seeing me for the first time.
I was supposed to be watching him that day, he says to his coffee cup.
I know, I say. Something inside me loosens, because I really do know. I set my cup on the counter, but it feels like I've just laid down something enormous, something very heavy. I look over at my dad's profile. A muscle in his jaw is working the way Debbie's does when she's trying not to cry. He looks so miserable, I want to say something to make it all better. It's okay.
No, he says. It's not okay.
No, really, I insist. Don't worry. You have enough to worry about with Sam and Mom.
Is that how it seems to you?
Yeah, I guess. Sometimes.
He runs his fingers through his hair, not making any real improvement. I trace a line in the powdered sugar on my plate. Well, I am, you know, worried about you. Now.
I'm okay, I say. It's almost worse, him being worried.
But I like it, too, a little. Peggy doesn't want us to pay, but my dad insists, and then says we'll also take a dozen donuts to go. As we're standing at the cash register, picking out two of this kind, two of that, I whisper that he should leave Peggy a big tip. He gives me a couple of dollars, and I walk back to where we were sitting and tuck them under my hot chocolate mug. She thanks us, and my dad reaches across the counter and shakes her hand. She doesn't act like this is dorky, so I decide to shake her hand, too. Then she goes off to wait on a couple of punk rockers. You wait here, my dad says. I'll get the car warmed up, then you can come out.
Sure, I say. Okay.
After a few minutes, he comes back and says the car's all warmed up. He looks ridiculously happy about this. I look for Peggy so she can see how I'm following her advice, but she must be in the kitchen. My dad holds the door for me as we leave Dunkin' Donuts, and he opens the car door for me when we get to the parking lot. I think about how normal we look compared to the punk rockers inside eating donuts. We must look like an old-time dad and daughter from some black-and-white TV show, but I don't care. I actually sort of like it. He puts the car in reverse, but keeps his foot on the brake. So, he says, where are we going? This hadn't occurred to me, the idea that there's a next step, and that it's up to me to decide what that next step is. Home, my dad says. I picture my mom and Sam sitting in the breakfast nook, tatting and sorting, Linus outside chasing a squirrel. Then I imagine Sydney blowing smoke rings on the porch, Tara inviting me to play ping pong, and the circle of feet in group the day I cried. I picture Ruby's white nurse's shoes and your little fabric shoes. I shake my head. Back to sick minds, I say. What? He says. That's what we call it, sick minds, instead of sea pines. Oh. He takes this in, then smiles. You sure? I wonder for a minute if I am sure. Then I know I am. Uh-huh, I say. For a while. He makes his thinking sound, then nods. Okay, he says. He takes his foot off the brake and we pull out of the parking lot. We cross the highway and swing past the payphone where the operator helped me call collect. Then the businesses on the highway glide by one, the carpet store with its loud sale signs, a video rental place, a Burger King, a Dairy Queen. I realize in an instant that the trip back to Sick Minds will be much faster than the trip away from it. Could you go a little slower? I say. He doesn't answer, doesn't ask why. He just does what I ask. I want to use every minute talking, but it's my dad who says something first. Sorry, I never came and saw you there. He says this quietly, glancing over at me, then back at the road. It's okay, I say. Will you quit saying that? He says. It's not okay. Okay, I say. Then, actually, I've got a lot of repressed hostility about it. He looks startled, then I laugh, and he laughs, and I offer a silent thank you to Amanda, who couldn't possibly know how she helped me. At least you brought Mom and Sam to visiting day, I say. Where'd you get that idea? I don't know. I just figured... Well, I didn't. He checks the rearview mirror, changes lanes, comes back to the conversation. She drove herself, he says.
Really?
Really.
I imagine my mom driving, achingly slowly, her and Sam strapped in their seatbelts, my mom leaning forward, her hands gripping the steering wheel.
Wow,
is all I can say. A band of light, the reflection from the rearview mirror, shines across my dad's features.
Things are a little different now,
he says haltingly. What do you mean?
After you left, you know, for, what do you call it? Sick minds?
I grin. This sounds funny coming from my dad.
We're trying harder now, he says. Your mom and me. I'm trying to be around more.
I can't quite picture him at the breakfast nook while my mom tats and Sam sorts, but I want to believe him, because he seems to need me to believe. We're at a stoplight. My dad looks over at me, studying my face. A horn beeps behind us. My dad checks the rearview mirror again, startled, as if he's forgotten we're on a busy road. When we pull up to the entrance of Sick Minds, I ask my dad if we can drive around the block once before we go in. He takes his foot off the gas and lets the car glide past. We drive slowly by a few scattered houses, then turn the corner and inch past a housing development. I clutch the box of donuts to my stomach and imagine what it'll be like to see everybody again. The dashboard clock says 7:12. It's only a few hours since I left, even though it feels like it's been days. At 7:12, everyone will be in evening study hall. Sydney and Tara and Debbie, even Amanda. Ruby will be patrolling the halls in her squeaky shoes, and suddenly I want to be back there. Right away. It's okay, I say to my dad. We can go in now. I sit in the waiting room outside Mrs. Bryant's office, the box of donuts still in my lap, while my dad goes in and explains. On the way in from the parking lot, I told him I was afraid they'd send me to Humdinger or maybe even kick me out. Let me handle it, he said. I remembered Peggy's advice and decided to go ahead and let him be the dad and me just be the kid. When he comes out with Mrs. Bryant, I notice that his hair is still a mess from being outside in the wind. I have an urge to fix it for him, get a comb and make it all neat again, but I can tell from the look on Mrs. Bryant's face that I have bigger things to worry about.
You had us worried, she says after we all sit down.
I'm sorry. I know this is the good manners thing to say.
Well, a sort of smile passes over her face. I'm glad you came back.
Me too. I mean this suddenly, with all my heart. They look at me like they don't quite understand, and I try hard to find the words that will make them see what I mean. I want... And then I know what it is I wanted so badly the day Tiffany went home, the day it first felt like spring, when I pictured kids riding bikes, dads cooking on grills, moms making lemonade. I want to get better. My dad starts patting his pockets like he's looking for something, but I know he's just trying to do something so he doesn't cry. I smile at him because I know this isn't something to cry about. My dad and Mrs. Bryant are talking about dates, insurance policies, adult stuff. But all I can think about is how when I get back to the dorm wing, I'm going to see if it would be okay if I offer everyone a donut. Then, tomorrow, I'm going down to your office first thing in the morning and tell you everything. This is Clea Lewis. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Cut by Patricia McCormick. This program was produced and directed by Taro Meyer. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2000 by Patricia McCormick. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.